From the newsroom of PCJ Radio International, this is Focus Asia Pacific. I'm Keith Perron. A record number of Pacifica police trainees have been recruited into New Zealand's police in the latest recruiting wing. Deputy Police Commissioner Wally Homama, who is responsible for Māori and Pacifica representation in the force, spoke to Dominic Godfrey about what is behind the increase.
We have got a really ambitious program underway, and I think what has contributed significantly to this has been the world's most entertaining recruitment video, which was seen by tens of millions of people across the globe. And inside of this country, more importantly, it encouraged more than 1,000 additional New Zealanders to apply to join the police. We expect that this will result in additional wings into the college. And look, I think there's been generally excitement across Māori, Pacific and ethnic and that whole diverse community in wanting to join the police, because that's what that video reflected around New Zealand's changing demographics.
So in terms of attracting Pasifika people, this has been very successful for the police, this recruitment program.
Well, absolutely. In our recent wing, we had a total of 18 in wing 314 that had come through. That's quite a significant number.
How does that compare to previous years' averages?
Well, the average is around about 4, 5 and 6 at the most. So that was quite a huge jump in the Pacific numbers that came through in that wing. And I think that's been because of the drive that our people out in the districts. We're running a Pacific course with Unitech, and we've been running courses with Unitech over several years. But again, we've just lifted the profile. And again, through the marketing recruitment video, this has certainly attracted quite a few more Pacific people into going out and doing the pre-recruitment courses.
So these Pasifika recruits, as they come through, where are they going to be placed? Is the aim to put them with Pasifika communities, or will they be in the general force?
Well, once they go through their general training and learn their craft on the streets, then it's about putting people where they can be deployed to maximise the use of their skills. So in Auckland, we've got a lot of our Pacific staff now that are working inside of Pacific communities, being able to apply the cultural connection and building their trust and confidence amongst the Pacific community. Likewise, Auckland, Christchurch, Wellington, in those areas where there are a large component of our Pacific population, it's about applying the skills in those areas where we can, again, gain the trust and confidence of those communities and work more collaboratively.
I understand you've got your first Ngāi Vanuatu police graduate this year.
Yes, likewise, we had a Niuean police graduate, Cook Island, 2 Fijians. But we are starting to grow quite a wide range of Pacific people coming into the organisation. And again, that's because of the wide campaign that we're running, plus with the large build-up of Pacific staff in our organisation that actively promote the New Zealand police as a career. I think, we're really reaching out to the community to say, hey, this is a great opportunity for people to come from that diverse background and bring the skills, knowledge, experience into the organisation.
So 4.9% of the current police force, Pasifika, is there a target beyond that? What is it?
At the moment, to 2025, we're trying to lift the numbers up. So we would like to reach about 7% at that time. Currently, the Pacific staff sit around 628 in the organisation.
What's the highest ranking Pasifika police officer in the New Zealand force at the moment?
At the moment, that stands at the rank of superintendent, the district commander in Central District, Palmerston North. That's Superintendent Sue Schwalger, and she does a brilliant job. We've got detective inspectors in Auckland who run crime squads in counties Manukau and Auckland Central. And, of course, there are a high number of Pacific people who sit at the rank of senior sergeant, sergeant, and we're encouraging more of our people to take up positions in seniority roles.
A psychologist who worked on Nauru and Papua New Guinea's Manus Island says the best treatment for the mental trauma of refugees is to resettle them in a safe country. Paul Stevenson counseled workers in Australia's offshore detention centre, but also trained guards, worked with interpreters, and was involved in strategic planning. He spoke to Ben Robinson-Drawbridge about children in the detention and reported a reduction in trauma counselling.
Every day there was an excessive amount of self-harm and suicidality I estimated about 400% what you'd expect on mainland. I often regarded the places as being a place where 1,200 people are trying to kill themselves every day and 600 staff are trying to stop them. There were incidents from headbutting, choking, hanging, through to starvation, eating foreign objects that they found lying around the place, like nails and screws and razors if they could find them, kitchen implements. There's a whole range of things that people would use to harm themselves in order to be able to protest.
Was it their captivity they were protesting, or was it things that they'd fled that led them to become asylum seekers?
Most of them arrived with a fair degree of post-traumatic stress disorder to start with, but they were complaining about the captivity, the fact that they were not allowed asylum in Australia, that they were taken to a foreign country, and believed that contravened international law. A lot of the transferees and asylum seekers were very educated people, and they were doctors and lawyers and scientists and people that were extremely knowledgeable about what was right and wrong and about international relations and all the rest of it. So they're very, very angry, of course, that they were deprived the justice which they should have been served.
For the PTSD, you said that they were inflicted by. Do you think that they were being treated for that adequately?
No. Nobody was really treated. The asylum seekers and refugees and the transferees on Manus Island, nobody was adequately given a psychological intervention. There was one psychologist on each of the islands, but again, with the communication difficulties and I think a desire to not try to intervene to make their lives any better, that people were just not treated. They arrived with having fled persecution, with substantial PTSD, but then they suffered more in the institutionalised lifestyle of the islands. Then it just became totally exacerbated, and of course their children on Nauru were born into captivity and never knew anything different. Probably the worst thing that I witnessed on Nauru, what I witnessed there was an incredible lack of attachment and bonding between parents and children. Because parents living in institutions didn't have any control over themselves, let alone their children. They couldn't discipline their children. They couldn't, for fear of being hauled up before the guards. They would not attach to their children because they never knew whether the children or themselves would get sick and die. They never knew at any point whether they would be separated from their children. And so the children would run fairly feral on Nauru, and they'd attach themselves to some of the benevolent, Save the Children Association workers or recreation officers or some of the more benign guards. The children sought out adults with whom they could attach, but not with their own parents, because their own parents were already too damaged to be effective parents.
So the withdrawal of trauma counselling services on Manus Island, what do you think the effect of that could be?
Well, I don't believe that there were any effective trauma counselling involved in the first place. The only thing that I ever saw the medical services doing there was treating people for medical conditions, and any kind of behavioural intervention was punitive and not really designed to help people.
In the future, what could this lack of treatment lead to? I mean, forgive me if I'm drawing too long a bow here, but
no.
Are people being created here that are going to have long-standing hostility towards Australia?
Well, I think that they'll have long-standing PTSD. I don't know that that means there'll be hostility so much. The best way to resolve the trauma that people have suffered is to have them settled someplace safe. There's no reason why people who are settled in a safe place can't be very good citizens and contribute to society. And I think that these people, if they're shown some compassion and could be settled in a safe and secure environment, they'll then revert to all of those things that they can contribute. As I say, they're doctors, nurses, scientists, People who are escaping persecution are not persecutors. People who are escaping terrorism are not terrorists. These are people who believe in something much better than what they've come from. And so I don't believe the radicalization is something that goes on in these camps. I think, to draw the conclusion that we need to be fearful of these people is ridiculous, in my view, because these are the people who are escaping terrorism.
A chief from the Fijian island of Ba has been released from custody amid a dispute over his installations of the paramount chief. The police and armed soldiers arrived in Ba early last Friday to head off a formal ceremony to install him in the paramount role of the Venatula of Ba. The native land commissioner instructed the police to stop the ceremony because of disagreement over who should take the title. A scholar of Fijian language and culture, Paul Garatti, told Sally Round it's unusual for the police to get involved in such chiefly matters.
The earliest observers noted that the Vunivalu of Ba, while there was never a king of Fiji, that the Vunivalu of Ba was the nearest thing there is, because he had influence or power over a large portion of eastern Fiji and even some smaller parts of western Fiji. So even in the middle of the 19th century, some of the early missionaries and European settlers were calling him the king of Fiji, or Tui Viti, as it is in Fijian, although in Fijian custom he would never be called that, but that's how important he is.
Yet the position has been vacant for quite a while now, since 1989. Why is that?
Well, it's officially vacant in the sense that there's nobody been officially installed or registered by the government, but there has been a couple of people who have been recognised as holding that position. And this is nothing new for this title or for some of the other titles of chiefly titles in Fiji. They often go for a long time without anyone being officially recognised. It's the same with the title of the Tui Nayao, the Chief of Lao, which was used to be held, of course, by the late Prime Minister and President Ratumara. Since he passed away, that has not been filled for various reasons. And it often happens because there is dissent among the family. Sometimes it happens because there's dissent among the Vunua, so the ordinary people. In fact, the Vunivalu of Bao in the early 20th century was vacant for about 50 or 60 years, something of that order. And various people, as they say in Fijian, they would nuvana kenambilo, they would drink the yangona or the kava first, and that would be the indication that they were in charge, but they were never actually formally installed. So it's not really a new thing, just that certain people with an obsession about registering these things get concerned about it, and they say, well, we must have somebody installed formally.
And the people of Mbao, as far as you know, were they keen to have somebody installed urgently?
I don't think urgently, but the feeling I get from the people of Mbao that I've spoken to is that they would like to have someone installed, but if it's going to cause friction, they'd rather not.
What was the friction surrounding this particular installation?
Well, this particular installation, the friction is due to the fact that the previous incumbent, who was Ratu George Kandavulevu, who was installed and he passed away about 30 years ago, I think, he had two marriages. It's the offspring from the first marriage versus the offspring from the second marriage. But there are also other things that enter into it. The fact that the oldest son, who was from the first marriage, has not lived on Bao for many, many years, whereas the oldest person from the second marriage, who's the sort of the other major claimant, has lived on Bao and has sort of been acknowledged as the leader for many, many years. But still, they cannot come to an agreement on which should be installed.
And the Native Lands Commission, an agency of the government, has stepped in?
Yes, that's right, because it also has a say on installation of chiefs. Then when it was discovered that the person who was resident on Bao wanted to go ahead with the installation and had support from a lot of other people on Bao, but not everybody, even though he's the younger one, when he made this clear, then the older one, who is not resident on Bao, but also has support from various factions, in, not only in Bao, but of course in all Bao's dominions, registered their objection with the NLC, and the NLC therefore gave the order that the installation should not go ahead, and that's when it became sort of political. It became the domain of the government rather than domain of local political organization, and that's why the police stepped in.
Is it extraordinary that the police did step in?
I think it is, because they have stepped in in the past in similar situations, but only when there was a real threat, just to keep the peace. I remember this happened in Lakemba in Laos, not because of dispute over who was to be the chief, but dispute who was going to be the bati, in other words, the people who would guard the sort of the soldiers of the realm, who would guard the village when a certain ceremony was taking place. That came to blows. When that sort of thing happens, then obviously I think it's okay for the police to step in. But in this case, it was it's rather different. As far as I know, nobody had actually come to... there was no disturbance of the peace, but it was considered, from what I understand, that the person who was going to be installed as the Vunivalu went ahead despite being ordered by this Lands Commission not to do so, and therefore that was considered to be breaking the law.
What impact will this have, do you think, this police stepping in?
Hard to say, and I think it's certainly not going to solve anything. This isn't a police job, but this is something that some other chief could probably settle. All disputes of this nature should really be best left to the people themselves to sort out, or according to the custom of the land. I think the best thing is to leave it, settle, let the people who have been traditionally responsible for it sort it out among themselves, and that the least government interference, the better.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. Growing grassroots solidarity has prompted the establishment of a West Papua desk in New Zealand. The desk is hosted at the Auckland Affairs of the First Union and is to be run by voluntary efforts. It's described as a hub for organizing events and raising awareness about independence aspirations and human rights violations in Indonesian ruled Papua. The Green Party MP, Marema Davidson, opened up the West Papuan desk on Monday night. She told Johnny Blades it's important New Zealand shows solidarity with Indigenous people in the Pacific.
And it's vital to help raise public awareness. So this dedicated space is the first time that we've actually had anything like this. And the hope is that we will coordinate efforts around the country and give a clearer light on what is actually happening in West Papua. The important thing is it's being driven from the ground.
There's been a growing awareness about West Papua in New Zealand, I feel, over the last few years.
Yeah, absolutely. And I feel that there hasn't been enough raising the media light on this issue. There has been growing awareness due also to the grassroots campaigns. I've seen a strong Pacific and Māori delegation in particular come forward and use their community organising skills to reach into ordinary households to get solidarity. There's been a particular rising with young Māori activists and students who align the issues of self-determination that are happening here with exactly what is happening in West Papua.
Is it having an impact?
Yeah, I think this is what has helped us arrived to this opening tonight of the West Papua desk at First Union in Auckland is because there are pockets of organising campaigns happening around Aotearoa and are getting so strong that we're realising that it would be efficient and strategic to have a centralising desk. And that actually highlights the work that is happening around different community campaigns standing in support.
Indonesia's government is pretty sensitive to this stuff, isn't it?
You're absolutely right. My colleague Gauri Skadaman, who is our international affairs spokesperson and our human rights spokesperson, will need support to make sure that at a government level we are communicating in the appropriate ways to make sure that we are highlighting the human rights abuses. Yes, it is sensitive. Of course it is. There is no government in the world that will want to own up to human rights abuses, but there simply are human rights abuses happening, and our government has a role to play in calling that to account.
President Jokowi did come to New Zealand not long ago, and it really didn't seem like it was particularly fleshed out, the West Papua issue.
Yeah, and I particularly around his visit, I made a public statement to say now is exactly the opportunity, and that the Greens had highlighted through the Prime Minister's office and to the Labor government that we would have liked this issue to be raised. What's at the heart of this is that trade agreements tend to undermine human rights issues, and I think what New Zealanders are coming to terms with is that that's no longer good enough, that we need to make sure that we are highlighting human rights issues and that we do not see any trade agreements or any diplomatic relationships as an excuse to push those under the carpet.
A linguist from the University of Hawaii at Maui says scientists have learned a lot from Pacific languages. Peter Shukla is in the Solomon Islands this month as part of an ongoing study of Rovani, a language from the Western Province. He says Rovani contains a cluster of unique features that defies the established linguistic theories. He says there is a need to document and preserve languages across the Pacific. He spoke to Corey Hawkins, a native Rohingya speaker, who began asking him how to learn about the language.
Well, I became interested in language endangerment, and I was interested in the principles of human language. And I read a paper by somebody about a particular syntactic feature in Roviana, and so I proposed a project to study it because I originally expected that I could explain how it wasn't as unusual or irregular as it looked. It's very, very unique, but it turns out it's exactly as it looked.
Can you give us an example of this anomaly?
It's a cluster of typological uniqueness in many ways and irregularity, which I'll give you an example. Languages like Spanish and Portuguese often agree with the subject. So I speak Portuguese, and in a word like to have, if it's I have, you'll say tenho. If it's he has, it'll be tem. So it's always the subject. But in Roviana, the verb only agrees with the object. There's no subject agreement. And there are actually linguists who predict that this is impossible, that you can't have object agreement without subject agreement. Additionally, they have case marking on the nouns, which is not common in European languages and most of the world's languages. As you know how see works and say works. For example, in English we say he slept, the intransitive subject is he, and then we say he kicked him. The transitive subject is he, and the object is him. But in Roviana, for the intransitive subject, you would put a see in front of it. Putasi rao, I sleep. Then, for the transitive object, you put a see in front of it. So, garatia siki siasa. The dog bit him. If this was in English, it would sound like this. Him slept, and he kicked him. So the him is with the intransitive subject in that case. And that pattern is very rare. And the fact that it's only, and the way the C works, it should just mark siki, garatia siki siasa. But instead it marks the asa, and it marks puta siasa too. This pattern is only truly attested in Roviana. And it's just one thing after another like this. I'm writing a whole dissertation about these things about Roviana, which they are logical possibilities that people could have predicted back in the 80s, but they didn't investigate enough languages, and so they proposed a lot of theoretical machinery to explain why it's impossible. So now it's very hard for them to accept that a language like Roviana indeed works that way.
And in the bigger scheme of things, with Pacific languages in general, this uniqueness, as you put it, is quite interesting, is it, in terms of the preservation of languages or the extinction of languages?
Actually, that's a really good point. I've made this point in talks I've given before that Roviana appears to be unique. However, there's been very little investigation of the languages of the Pacific generally. For example, if you take Papua New Guinea, you have, by some accounts, 800 languages. Maybe 100 or less have been investigated to some extent seriously. Most of language science is based on a survey of about 5% of the world's languages. There's 7,000 languages, maybe 2,000 of them in the Pacific. And the majority of language science is based on European languages and East Asian languages and the like, languages that people had easy access to. And so, for example, I went into Roviana and I asked how to say Bill pinched himself. And I checked to see if you could say himself pinched Bill, which you can't say in English, right? And as far as I can tell, no one has ever checked a very simple thing like that in any Solomon Island language. So these things that appear very unique about Roviana could be more common than people think if they investigated it. But the most important thing is to go and document these languages for science and for posterity for the communities involved, because it's predicted that within 100 years, 50 to 90% of all the world's languages will be extinct. And so it's a great loss for science if we think these patterns can't exist, but they do. And it's, in my opinion, a larger loss for humanity and the individual cultures involved.
And you're on your way to Solomon Islands now. This is one of several trips that you've done already. What is it that you're doing and where?
Yes, this year I'm going out to the Western Province again, which is so far my favorite place, and I'm going to continue investigating all aspects of Roviana grammar because I am slowly working on a large description and I'm going to collect narratives and conversations from people, which we will transcribe and translate. And then I keep them in a Kaipuleohone archive in Hawaii so that anyone can go and access them. Specifically, hopefully, that Roviana people now or forever can go access it. I think, so I'm working on Roviana because I'm one person, but this kind of conservation and documentation could be conducted in every Solomon's language.
And so your ultimate aim is it to try and develop a pathway whereby indigenous people themselves might investigate this kind of work?
Yes. If I could get any sort of funding, say Bill Gates decided he cared about language endangerment, well, what I would like to do is maybe go to the Solomons and find bright people who are curious and interested in language and to train them in linguistics. There's no linguistics courses available at all in the Solomon Islands, and it's one of the nations with the richest linguistic diversity in the world. And I believe that language science can be very empowering because you don't need a $5 million lab to do it. You can go and start language science, and you don't need a deep background in mathematics or anything. You can start right away. Of course, as a second language speaker, I can add some things and help do some things, but you can imagine that a native speaker of a language has insights that I will never have.
And that's all we have time for on this edition of Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. If you wish to contact us to let us know what you think of the program, we'd love to hear from you. Our email address is focus@pcjmedia.com. Once again, focus@pcjmedia.com. You can also write us at our general email address, pcjmedia@gmail.com. On behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Powell, wishing you well, saying so long, take care. We'll see you again very soon for another edition of Focus Asia Pacific. Until next time, so long and take care. Bye-bye.